Welcome to Box Office Bob-Ombs. If a movie is based on a video game, chances are it's gonna blow. Across the aisle from me is a man that I wouldn't trust to sauce my wings, let alone command them, Dylan Flynn.
And across the aisle from me, a man who once rented an apartment from the leader of the Velvet Underground, making him something of a lieutenant, Mr. Trevor Ickrath.
Damn, that one was kind of a long walk for me. I'm not going to lie.
For a short drink, would you also specify?
No. Once I got to my destination, I was quite nourished. I really enjoyed how that one resolved.
Trevor, how are you today? And I'm not just asking for show patter. I genuinely care.
I'm fine. You know, it's a bright, sunny Saturday morning here in South Pasadena. We've kind of switched to like an earlier recording schedule, which I think is behooving the show. So I'm excited to get this episode done.
Spring has sprung. Daylight savings time is in effect. It's a time for a young man and a young woman to make eyes at one another and for two relatively old men to talk about a movie together.
Sure, not just any movie. 1999's Wing Commander.
Battle station.
To fight this kind of enemy, you need a new kind of soldier.
It's your boy, Soldier Boy. My new video game console is here. Fuck PlayStation, fuck Xbox, fuck Nintendo. Yeah, the first African-American rapper to come out with a video game console. Bitch!
Wing Commander, rated PG-13.
You have to imagine clicks are going to be through the fucking roof this week. People have been waiting for the Wing Commander episode.
I know I have been, chiefly to finally find out what exactly Wing Commander is, because this is the first game that we've covered that I was completely unfamiliar with.
Well, let me start by filling you in that it was released by 20th Century Fox on March 12th, 1999, and that it was based on the space flight simulation game Wing Commander, published by Origin Systems for MS-DOS PCs in 1990.
Right. And I didn't learn until I opened this notes document brief moments ago that this is not technically a video game. It is kind of an adjacent breed, the computer game. And I feel like if you were looking for an example of what makes computer games distinct from video games, especially back in this era, I would say Wing Commander has got to be a perfect example, I think.
Your podcast host approves of this statement.
I think the easiest way to explain it, at least back in the 90s, video games were like fun and cool, and computer games were for fucking nerds.
Nerds, for sure.
Yeah.
This movie, believe it or not, cost $27 million to produce and earned only $11.6 million internationally at the box office.
We'll talk about it, but I think they did an okay job getting a lot of that money up onto the screen.
I wonder if perhaps it was up on a few too many screens, however, because it opened on 2,019 screens. In 1999, do you think the words Wing Commander would have meant enough to enough people to merit that kind of a massive nationwide release?
Not really, but at the same time, this does feel like an era where, like, the movie equivalent of, like, shovelware was kind of happening in the sci-fi genre. Like, if I'm a studio guy and somebody shows me this, I'm like, yeah, we'll get the Star Trek nerds in to see it at least.
Tell me a little bit about the creatives involved. Who made Wing Commander?
Sure. This is, I think, probably one of the most interesting things about it. It's the only feature film to be directed by Chris Roberts, who is the video game developer and programmer who created the Wing Commander franchise.
That feels like a big moment for this show, at least, right?
A big moment for this show, a big moment for, like, you know, video game adaptations in general. It's like they finally, like, this, he was the first guy that they didn't take it away from.
And more than taking it away from, handing the keys to. Like, it's crazy to think that you could be making MS-DOS games and then years later, helming a Hollywood film.
Yeah, here's $27 million, go nuts.
And I guess he stuck around in Hollywood after the movie, too. I mean, he didn't direct anything else, but he did executive produce some stuff. He oversaw such hit films as The Punisher, Lucky Number 11, and, oh, who could forget, Trevor, Who's Your Caddy?
Yeah, most recently in 2010, Roberts launched a controversial video game project called Star Citizen, which has to date raised over $500 million in Kickstarter funds, but still hasn't released after 14 years of development.
Just transferred right over to scamming video gamers.
Do you think he's been secretly funding a sequel to Wing Commander 1999?
Maybe Star Citizen is a bit of a backdoor sequel to Wing Commander 1999, because it does have some key personnel in common. I know Mark Hamill is involved.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you kind of do need to do a little digging to find out that he was involved in this movie, but he's in there. And I believe he was in the original Wing Commander video games too, right?
That's right. That's right. So Wing Commander, people are thinking, what is it? What exactly is going on? Maybe you can answer some of those questions and give us a brief overview of the story of Wing Commander.
The Kilrathi, an evil race of feline aliens, stole a device that will let them hyperjump to Earth and destroy it. The only ship that can intercept their fleet in time to stop the attack is a starfighter called the Tiger Claw. But between stubborn commanders, racial tensions, and impossible odds, it's going to take a miracle.
Oh, okay. I see.
Yeah.
Yeah, world explode if we don't ...
We'll talk about how we feel about the movie in general, but this actually felt like a relatively adult plot for a movie to me.
Can I say, I'm so glad you used that word, because the thing that was probably one of the most positive things about this film for me was kind of feeling like we were moving a little bit away from little kid movie here.
Yeah, I mean, like, if you, like, take your kids to go see this movie thinking that you're in for, like, a fun Star Wars-esque space adventure, you gotta be really squirming through the first, like, pretty much the first half of this thing, which is just, like, middle-aged men talking about, like, how long it will take their ship to get to a jump point, like, in rooms.
In recent episodes past, this has been one of the, I think, probably flabbiest sections of our show, but today for Wing Commander, our cast of characters is a fairly focused, tight little group, Trevor.
Pretty much, yeah. Not only is it not very big, but there's, like, something pretty interesting a few of them have in common.
Well, we start, of course, with the biggest face on the poster, Lieutenant Christopher Blair. He's a half-Pilgrim rookie pilot whose mixed background makes him a target of racism and suspicion, played by 90s heartthrob Freddie Prinze Jr., Fred, in the Scooby-Doo series of films.
That's right. And I think we should, you know, just provide an extremely brief background on what the Pilgrims are. I guess the best way to explain them is, like, they were the first group of people once mankind started expanding out into the stars. This movie takes place, when was it, like, 26th century?
Some humans went out into space to try to navigate and chart space, and then those people kind of got weird powers and became...
Yeah, they were so good at space exploration that they turned into, like, special boys, and they were touched by God.
And then eventually they became so touched by God that they kind of declared war against the other humans, and now it's a sticking point for the humans, the whole Pilgrim thing.
Right. If you are kind of associated with the Pilgrims, you are heavily stigmatized in this day and age.
That's right.
Like our young hero, Lieutenant Christopher Blair.
Not so much stigmatized by his BFF.
That would be Lieutenant Todd Maniac Marshall. A mouthy show-off whose recklessness in the cockpit makes him a liability, played by Matthew Lillard, none other than Shaggy from the Scooby-Doo film series.
Not only that, but these guys have been in a number of films together.
It's like they're two guys who find each other in every possible alternative universe, you know? In another life, I would have really liked solving mysteries with a dog and exploring space with you.
And rounding out our little trio of heroes, you got Lieutenant Angel Devereaux, the titular wing commander who struggles to lead her fellow starfighters as a team, played by Saffron Burroughs, who I'm sorry to say has not, to date, appeared in any Scooby-Doo movies.
Yeah, there's still time, but we are breaking the streak for now. Next up, we've got James Paladin Taggart, Blair's wise but mysterious French mentor, played by Checky Carrillo.
This guy's got a fairly gritty and interesting performance style, especially earlier in the film. They eventually start pulling out these, like, big reveals, like, oh, he's a naval intelligence officer. Oh, he's also a Pilgrim, you know, so
yeah.
He's kind of off in C-plot territory for most of the movie.
Kind of the Raiden of the film.
Sure, he's a little bit Raiden, he's a little bit Obi-Wan, he's got a number of roles he's playing here, you know?
We've also got Commander Paul Gerald, a racist officer who's stuck in his ways, played by Jürgen Prochnow. now.
I think what's interesting about this is that this guy, this German fuck, was the scary commander in Das Boot, which Chris Roberts obviously is kind of patterning this movie off of. This is Das Boot in space, so it's fun that he got the Das Boot guy to be in his Das Boot pastiche.
Yeah, it definitely lends the movie a little bit of gravitas, doesn't it? We've also got Lieutenant Rosie Forbes, Matthew Lillard's feisty and fearless love interest, played by Ginny Holder.
As well as Captain Jason Sansky, a bald guy who is helming the Tiger Claw, played by David Suchet.
And rounding out the cast, we've got Admiral Jeffrey Tolwyn, top brass of the Terran Confederation Navy, played by David Warner. I don't really remember this guy's role, but I assume he was one of the several old men standing around on the ships.
At the beginning, he's like, we've got to get Freddie Prinze Jr. And at the end, he goes, you did it, Freddie Prinze Jr.
Yep. Nice bookend there.
At the end of the book, the critics speak up, so why don't we talk about what they said about Wing Commander on Rotten Tomatoes? It has a 10% critic score and a 26% user score. We've seen lower, we've seen higher.
Let me into your process a little bit. When you sit down to watch these movies, are you generally going into them knowing what the scores and, like, you know, the pre-established general opinions out there are on them?
In weeks past, yes, but specifically for Wing Commander, I decided, because I knew so little about the property, I should just go in as blind as possible. I just rolled tape.
I did the same thing. Yeah. Were you surprised when you saw how low the scores were?
It gave me a moment of pause. The user score, not so much, just because people be showing up in those things to be like, it's not like the game I love. That I get.
Yeah.
But the critic score down to 10% did surprise me a little bit. I was kind of thinking we'd be somewhere around 40 to 50.
I was thinking maybe 30s, you know, because I really don't expect any of these like old 90s video game adaptations to get much respect. But I was surprised to see us down to almost the single digits for this one.
Yeah, pretty close. One of those professionals, Tom Bennett of the Film Journal International, said, Wing Commander is a completely vapid special effects reel that would make a pretty nice screensaver for a computer, but as far as a 90-minute movie, it can lean somewhat towards the tedious.
Rotten Tomatoes user Cece says, I lied and said there was a laser pointer in the theater when I saw this in eighth grade so I could get my money back. Does that work?
I mean, it did back then, because I think it was so in the zeitgeist that laser pointer people were out and about, and you got to watch out for them, you know?
Yeah, so people did not like this movie.
Can I use this as an opportunity to talk to you about something that I experienced as I dove into the user reviews of this movie?
Okay.
In weeks past, it's always so easy for me to find like a poorly worded, misspelled mess written by a total idiot.
Yeah.
As soon as your movie is about quasars and jump points and fucking
the Ulysses Corridor,
suddenly everybody's got their Queen's English on. They're writing full paragraphs. The average IQ of the Wing Commander viewer has come up considerably than Street Fighter and Mortal Kombat.
Yeah. It just really failed to capture the nuances of, you know, space-based combat and strategy that I can only assume was present in the original games.
Yeah, nobody's out here in the comments talking about Freddie Prinze Jr.'s hot little body, although maybe they should be.
Maybe they should. Well, I want to talk about some trivia?
Yeah, sure. We've already kind of mentioned it, but the cast of the video game's live-action cutscenes arguably more impressive than the movie's cast. In Wing Commander 3, the last game that came out before the movie, Blair was played by Mark Hamill, Admiral Tolwyn by Malcolm McDowell, Taggart by John Rhys-Davies, who I'm sure you know as Gimli from Lord of the Rings, Maniac, Tom Wilson, Biff from Back to the Future. Hello, McFly! Anyone home?
Pretty star-studded cast. I can understand why they weren't able to get any of them into the movie, especially Mark Hamill, who would have like obviously been too old to play Blair.
That's true.
But they did still like manage to work him in, as we alluded to earlier. They made him the voice of Merlin, Blair's onboard AI navigation assistant, although in the credits, he was credited simply as ?
That definitely seems like, I think the reason a lot of times these guys go uncredited is that there's like some kind of a SAG rule that they're bypassing. But when you put the question mark in, that's like your dick's so hard to tell people that Mark Hamill's in your movie.
Yeah. So like a few movies we've already covered, this one had script problems and it kind of underwent like major rewrites, allegedly, at a certain point, like shortly before filming.
Chris Roberts co-wrote the initial screenplay that was sold to Fox with Kevin Droney, who wrote Mortal Kombat, the 1995 adaptation of Mortal Kombat, so that's a connection. But then producer Todd Moyer thought that the script would be too expensive for them to shoot on their pretty small budget, so he hired Beetlejuice screenwriter Larry Wilson to revise that script and kind of tone down the production values.
Right, and Roberts, in a later interview, said, "What Kevin and I wrote wasn't Shakespeare, but it was better than what we shot. Every new draft that Todd sent us got worse and worse and worse."
Man, and what about Freddie Prinze Jr.? I love this quote. Can you please deliver me the Freddie Prinze Jr. quote?
He said, "I read the script and loved it. So did my pal, Matthew Lillard. We went on location and they said, here's the new script. It was a piece of crap. I can't stand Wing Commander. I can't watch one scene of that movie."
He's not here for it, my guy.
I really gotta wonder what the original script for this movie looked like, because I feel like I can't really detect too many compromises.
Right.
Maybe they were like disappointed by like a reduction in how much action there was or something. Who knows?
Maybe.
Speaking about action, this movie saw at least a little bit of a bump in action, because it was one of several movies that was honored to carry the trailer of Star Wars Episode I, The Phantom Menace, when that was coming out. Remember those days?
Yeah, I actually remember the trailer being out being a huge fucking news story at the time.
People would go see Wing Commander just to see this trailer, or would they?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes people online would sort of brag to their knucklehead friends, "Yeah, I bought tickets to Wing Commander, watched the trailer, and then I fucking left."
You got to imagine Freddie Prinze Jr. and Matthew Lillard standing behind, like, you know, an old-ass 90s computer reading things like that. Just a single tear dropping down their cheek.
"That first draft was so much better."
Maybe if they'd stayed, they really could have gotten into it, though.
I guess Star Wars is kind of a shadow looming over the whole production. 20th Century Fox was concerned that Wing Commander just bore a little too much resemblance to Star Wars, and they pressured Chris Roberts to finish the movie with only 3 months of post-production for all of the VFX. I think originally he was supposed to have 8 months to work on the movie, just so that they could put it out a whole year in advance of The Phantom Menace. However, once Roberts did deliver the finished film on time with the crazy schedule, Fox didn't like it and decided to shelve the movie.
Yeah, in this day and age, this thing would have gone right in the trash can for that sweet, sweet write-off, probably.
In the Zaslav incinerator.
Yeah. But while the movie was shelved, another film starring Freddie Prinze Jr. and Lillard, Can't Hardly Wait, kind of became a sleeper hit. So Fox dusted off Wing Commander and released it anyway, only 2 months before the premiere of Episode One.
The studios are always behaving in such schizophrenic ways, you know, like something is the most important thing to them, and then 3 months later, it's something else, you know?
Let's talk about, do you want to unpack our feelings about this thing? Because, like,
yeah, I do have a really, really brief, like, my only context for Wing Commander for you.
Okay, yeah.
I specifically remember that you know how most towns have, like, a free weekly newspaper?
Yeah.
In town, we've got the Eugene Weekly, and I specifically remember I would always grab it. There was a kiosk by, like, my middle school or whatever, and I would flip right to the movie reviews, and I saw Wing Commander got a little bomb symbol next to it, so I was always excited to read somebody trash a movie. Mm-hmm. And then I'm reading based on a video game, and I'm thinking, how come I ain't ever heard of it if it's based on a video game? Yeah. What the fuck's this?
I got a Nintendo. Watching this one was kind of like, I'm not going to say it was like a roller coaster or a journey for me, but I definitely did like find myself going back and forth a lot on how I felt about it. And I wound up feeling a little more complicated about it than I initially hoped I would in the first maybe third of the movie. Because I will say, like, sitting down watching this movie, at least in the opening 20 minutes or so, it was kind of impressing me.
I think it's got a strong second act. I think that it's got an okay first act, a strong second act, and then kind of a rote third act.
Yeah.
I also kind of came out the other end of it feeling probably more positive than negative. I also do think that we are experiencing this movie in kind of the perfect on-ramp, where, like, for weeks we have sat through PG-13 movies for children,
yeah,
in which people fart and burp and punch each other in the balls, and then, like, all of the sudden you've got, like, human drama, are we all gonna die, and it just suddenly felt like, oh, I'm watching a movie, an actual movie is being played.
Yeah, like, this felt like it would have been like a great, like, pilot episode to, like, a prestige sci-fi network show or something.
Mm-hmm. Or even, like, just a UPN late 90s one that nerds love. Stargate, Farscape,
Babylon 5. Definitely. I almost like recommended this movie to my dad, who like enjoys that genre of things. But I wound up not doing that just because I thought the third act of this movie like really just totally failed to deliver in any way for me.
Yeah, it's sort of, we're stuck with these movies. So we're gonna salvage the things we can from them. And I think, you know, taken from that approach, there's stuff to like about Wing Commander, and I did like that stuff.
Definitely, me too. And, you know, I think we'll talk a little bit more in depth about that as we start, you know, selecting our tier picks. So let's get into it.
As fondly as I may feel about Wing Commander on the whole, I am licking my chops a little bit to be responsible for the F tier this week.
Okay, I found myself, you know, thankful because I was not really finding myself hating anything about this movie. So I'm interested to see what you identified as like the worst of the worst of it.
Dude, I knew the second the credits hit, I'm putting it in the F tier. The very confusing and convoluted stakes of Wing Commander are the worst thing about Wing Commander.
Okay.
Let me try to bring you through this, okay?
Yeah.
The bad guy cat aliens, they have stolen something from a big ship. It's called a navcom. Now, what that's going to let them do is jump too close to Earth. But here's the thing. They're going to be there in 40 hours, but the good guy ships can only get there in 42 hours. So we got to give an order to this other ship to go to a different ship, because that ship can get to a jump point in 23 hours, but the bad guys, it'll take them 25 hours so they can intercept them.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. They're going to find the navcom, and now the plan's got to change because we can't just stop them. We got to go warn Earth so that they can. It's just like, what the fuck is happening in this movie? It is so overly complicated, and there's like a huge smokescreen of jargon surrounding everything. They're always talking about, you know, this quadrant, this quasar, this pulsar. It's just, you know, guys, go back to the script room. You got some fine characters here. You've got a good setup. Just like simplify what's happening here.
Yeah, it's extremely dense. Trying to like figure out what's going on in this movie is like bashing your head against a brick wall. And like, that's kind of that, and the jargon is really what I appreciated the most about it. Like, I'm glad it didn't hold my hand. I'm glad it didn't appeal to a baser audience. It's nice seeing a movie in this genre just be like, no, this is what the movie's about. And like, you got to meet us on our terms. You know, we're not going to be thrown in the burps. We're not going to be thrown in the farts. Like, you just got to kind of figure out where we're going with this.
This movie also does a thing that I think a lot of 90s sci-fi did, where they just did not bother at all to let you in on the bad guys and why they're doing what they're doing and what they're about, to the point that it's absurd, because early on in the movie, there's a line dropped about the alien race that they want to destroy the universe.
This actually segues really well into my D tier pick.
Okay.
Because my D tier pick is the Kilrathi.
Oh, man, yeah.
I mean, you know, they're the main antagonists of the film, but I feel like for the most of it, they're kind of a non-entity. Like, we got a lot of exposition on the Pilgrim War and that, like, side of this fictional universe, but I don't really believe we ever learned too much about them or what their race or culture is like, except for, like you just said, they want to destroy the universe, I guess. I don't know where they're going
to
go.
It's interesting. I'm so glad that the Kilrathi are here, because there's some things I was hoping to chat with you about with them.
Go for it.
So apparently Roberts was like humiliated with how they turned out, the practical puppet guys, the suits.
They don't look good. You know, we've seen some pretty out there puppetry and movie magic creations, and I would not rank the Kilrathi as being near the top of that list.
I guess Chris Roberts, like when he first saw the Kilrathi suits on set, he said that he almost had to like go back to his trailer and cry about it. He was so upset. And like, they were so tall that they didn't fit in the sets that they had built. So the actors had to hunch over and have weird posture. It just really didn't work out, the Kilrathi of it all.
If I were the director of this movie and I walked on set and these guys were bubbling around, I probably would have needed to go back to my trailer and have a good cry myself. Star Trek was like doing like way better aliens on TV.
Oh, so for sure.
I really don't think there's any excuse for this kind of thing in like a big budget movie like this.
I got the C tier this week, and let me tell you, buddy.
That's right.
I know exactly what to put here. That thing that's almost good, but ultimately hurts the movie.
Yeah, I really struggled with, you know, my equivalent B tier pick this week. So I'm going to be interested in seeing what you've selected for the C tier.
I'm going to put into the C tier Freddie Prinze Jr.'s beautiful baby brown eyes.
He's definitely, you know, like a human deer, kind of.
He keeps doing the Zoolander face, you know, he keeps doing the Blue Steel face. He's trying to make those eyes pop, Trevor.
Yeah.
He's trying to get that Tiger Beat centerfold. He's trying to sell a few fucking shirtless posters to some 11-year-old girls, Trevor. He's got to make the face.
I mean, that's what he's bringing here, right? Because otherwise I was not super into the Freddie Prinze Jr. performance.
No.
He was one of the weaker members of the cast for me.
He's got decent chemistry with Matt Lillard, I'll say.
Yes, yeah. Our requisite two guys.
There's several long shots of his face in this movie where I feel like I can just hear his internal dialogue just like screaming, look cute.
Gotta turn it on.
Look cute. I think in a movie that was like aiming for a sillier, schlockier tone, like, you know, Street Fighter, for example, what Freddie Prinze Jr. is doing here would be kind of an asset to the vibe. But obviously, this is a movie that's like asking you to buy into its whole world of political tension and the fate of humanity and all that stuff. And I mean, I laughed at some of those shots, but it's fair to say that that's probably detracting from the quality of the film that's happening.
Sure. I do like thinking about the possibility of a bunch of like hardcore sci-fi fans going to see this movie only to leave after the trailer for Star Wars Episode One, and then the remaining audience being comprised like completely of like young teenage girls who are there for Freddie Prinze Jr.
Yep. Yeah, they've got all of their pictures they printed out in the school library of him and their Trapper Keepers.
All of these movies inevitably have their own, however small, pool of people who still like them just because they saw them at the right age and there's that nostalgia there. I have to imagine that like anyone who's going to bat for Wing Commander in 2024 has got to be like, you know, somebody who was an early teenage girl in 1999. They're like, yeah, it's pretty good. You know, we had it on VHS. I watched it as a kid.
It's like the JTT Lion King thing or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think Freddie Prinze Jr. has cooled it like post this, you know, in those Scooby-Doo movies, he's being a goofball and he's having a good time.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's my C-tier pick. So you said it was a little dicey for you in the B-tier this week. Where'd you ultimately come down?
This is kind of related to some stuff we were talking about with the movie's over convoluted plot. But for the B-tier, I've selected this movie's sense of dignity.
Mm.
I think you can really tell it was directed by the guy who created the material it's based on. And on top of that, I think you can tell that like this guy really believes and is like invested in his own material, just because there's like, it feels like there's such a lack of compromise here in bringing it to a potentially larger audience.
Yeah.
He doesn't fill it with jokes or any TNA or any eye candy or anything like that. If you're not here for a movie comprised primarily of middle-aged men, like talking about how long it's going to take for their spaceship to reach a jump point, you're just kind of out of luck until the last act when they finally do start doing some dogfights.
Yeah.
Part of me has like a really deep respect for that, just like a refusal to bend towards bigger popular culture. But I think in its devotion to its own kind of like sense of self-seriousness, this movie totally forgets to like really have any fun or do anything that's like cool.
Yeah.
Like I said, it's the perfect movie representation of a computer game versus a movie based on a video game.
You're so right. It's a little too stuffy.
It's really refreshing to see a video game movie carry itself with this kind of like stature. But at the end, it really does kind of shoot itself in the foot.
Yeah, I think that's a great pick for the B tier because it is, I think, one of the more compelling things about the film that it's going for this tone at all.
Mm-hmm. So what have you got for the A tier?
I'm taking a sequence to put into the A tier. It's the one that stuck with me the most. It's the sequence where Matthew Lillard, maniac, his showboating costs the life of his girlfriend, Rosie.
Sure. It's pretty interesting, I thought, that, you know, for 99% of this thing, Matthew Lillard is like the only source of comic relief, and that's his like pretty much his only job in the movie.
Yeah.
But then he winds up getting like pretty much the like big emotional core scene of the film as well.
Well, you know, he was an American Academy of Dramatic Arts graduate. He studied at Circle in the Square. He's like a classic hungry young actor in this movie. And so
he always dependably turns in a good performance too. Like I saw him in like the top three actors in this movie, and I knew that like even if I wasn't going to enjoy the film, he would probably be doing something pretty good in it.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear you say that. I've always been an apologist of Matthew Lillard, a defender of Matthew Lillard.
Yeah.
And I have good news for you, without giving you any spoilers. He's in two more different video game movies, so we'll be seeing him again.
That doesn't surprise me. I know what at least one of them is, because I know it was pretty recent, I believe.
It was pretty recent, yeah. Let me talk about this scene, though. First of all, I really like this relationship between Ginny and Maniac. I like how young and dumb and horny they are, and I like how their attraction and their connection seems to be mostly predicated on doing really dangerous shit to impress each other.
Uh-huh.
There's that scene where they're about to, the Tiger Claw is going to do a hyper jump that's going to be like really dangerous. And Maniac like unbuckles himself from his chair to show off to his girlfriend and like squats kind of surfer style on his seat.
Yeah.
And it's contrasted with their wing commander, Devereaux. Like she bangs her head and gets bloodied from it. So you're already, they're feeding you this idea that these two star-crossed lovers are perhaps a bit fatalistic in the way that they're romantically interacting with one another. Mm-hmm. So they're off on a mission. They're called back to the Tiger Claw, and they're too kill horny to go back. They want to shoot down a few enemies first. So they break orders. Maniac's playing chicken. He's like, he's flying right at the enemy. He's not shooting. And Rosie's getting scared. She's like, stop it. Shoot him down. Stop doing this. And so she decides to follow behind him, like maybe a little too close to try to give him some cover support. He finally blows up the bad guy ship. Bam, it smacks her starfighter. Her eject lever is fried, and they try to make it back to the Tiger Claw. He lands, but her ship just like crashes right outside of the airlock, and he's just powerless to stand there and watch while like the cleanup crew pushes her corpse and her wrecked starship off the runway. And then at his lowest, here comes the wing commander, Angel Devereaux, furious, puts her service weapon to his head, and he's like, defying an order in a time of war is treason, and I have the right to execute you right here.
Yeah.
Blair's trying to talk her down. Freddie Prinze Jr. is like, listen, he's got to live with this for the rest of his life. Don't do this. And then he's like, stop. He pushes Blair aside. He's ready. He's going to accept it. And then either, I can't tell in that moment of performance if Angel like doesn't have the nerve to kill him, or just kind of knows in her heart that it's not what's right for the team.
Yeah.
But she puts it down, and then the look on Matthew Lillard's face when it dawns on him that Blair's right, this is a moment that he will now have to live with forever. That's movie making. That's great stuff.
Yeah, this was a really good scene for all the reasons you just explained. The movie, I feel like if it had like two or three more of scenes of this quality in it, like we could potentially be looking at like a real banger here.
It would be a winner, yeah, if they had a couple more like that. They try for another big tense one, but I don't know that it quite crackles the way that this does.
Yeah, maybe it's the one that I'm going to be talking about next, because for the S tier, I have also selected a single sequence in the movie.
Oh, yeah.
And that has got to be the one where the Tiger Claw makes the jump to the Ulysses corridor and time on board the ship temporarily freezes.
Oh, yeah. That's a sick moment. Yeah, for sure.
That was extremely sick, like to the point where like I feel like this was at the very end where I was still completely on board with this movie before it really started to just like slow down and like stop doing the stuff that I was really into. First of all, there's a lot of very tense build up to this scene happening. Like it's like the most important jump in the movie that they got to make. Like they all think they're about to die. Time completely freezes. The sound in the movie cuts out, which is very cool. And I was just like, I was so shocked to see a movie like of this level doing something that felt so like stylistically adventurous that I was just like, are you kidding me?
They even do the little Matrix pivot where they've set up, you know, obviously some photography cameras in the little arc so that while time is frozen, you can kind of move around the space a little bit. Very cool.
So yeah, it joins the, for now, very exclusive club of moments I had to rewind to watch a second time. It's in there with Scorpion shouting suckers in Mortal Kombat Annihilation.
Totally. Oh, man. Great tier list this week.
Good tier list this week, I would say.
Well, while we're in the 1990s anyway, why don't we open up a copy of GamePro magazine?
Right, and let's talk about our ratings in the different, you know, areas that we talk about for these movies, starting with graphics.
Yeah, graphics. You know, 3 months of post-production, yeah, the CGI, it looks a little rough.
Yeah, I was torn on this one myself, because I do feel like a lot of the exterior shots of the larger spacecraft look pretty good, especially for this era. On the other hand, I think the dogfights frequently look pretty janky.
Yeah, they do.
Like, whenever they get into those smaller crafts, And as we've already said, the Kilrathi are basically huge flops. So I'm going to take the good with the bad. Ultimately, I'm going to go right down the middle on this one and give it a 3.
Something that's interesting is that this movie never goes planet side. You are always in hangars or cockpits or, you know, bunks or whatever. Mm-hmm. And to that, I do think that the set builds are decent.
Yeah.
I think that big hangar looks pretty good that they spend a lot of the time in.
Yeah.
I'll probably go down to 2.5 from you because I'm not sure if there was anything visually that like really stunned me though.
Yeah, that sounds fair. Talking about the sound, I thought this one was pretty unmemorable, both in terms of the score and the sound effects. You know, it's hard being a spaceship movie and having to compete with movies like Star Wars that are pretty much titans in the field of music and sound, but this one really did nothing to distinguish itself at all for me. I do feel like at least the sound design was like at least kind of competently done, and the score was like a good enough fit for the tone of the movie. So I'm going to give it a 2, but I can't really go higher than that.
I'm going to disagree with you on the score.
Yeah.
I think that the main theme, the overture theme, which was composed by Dave Arnold and Kevin Kleiner, is really good. I even found myself like humming it in the days following.
Oh, man, I could not tell you. I could not remember a note.
Oh, you mean you want me to hum it for you now? Sure, I'll do that. No problem, Trevor.
Sure, please. Yeah, do it.
Bum, 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 bum. Bum, 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 bum. Bum, bum, bum. Bum, bum, bum. Bum, bum, bum. Can you feel it?
No.
Bum, 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 bum. Bum, 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 bum. Bum, bum, bum. Bum, bum, bum. Bum, bum, bum.
Now, I feel like a poor Tim Allen impersonator playing Buzz Lightyear at Disneyland is about to tell me, like, you know, how to use the little laser pointer on the front of my cart to shoot as many aliens and get as many points as possible, because this will be reflected in my Starfleet record.
Sure, I'll sign your autograph book, Little Cadet.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I hear you. The mix is pretty good. I think the sound effects are standard, but they're decent. There is that one scene that's kind of ridiculous where everybody on the Tiger Claw has to be really quiet because the Kilrathi bomber is like trying to find them and dropping bombs all over the place.
Yeah.
But there is a cool thing about that scene, which is that there's no score and no dialogue, but you just get the radar beep that's like slowly speeding up through the scene. That's kind of cool.
That's a cool, you know, intentional bit of sound design. I like stuff like that. But again, my favorite part of this movie is when sound cuts out entirely. So
I'll go up from you because I like that main theme. I think the rest of the score may be pretty forgettable. I'll give it a 3.5.
Okay, all right. Let's talk about control then. This is how we kind of weigh how much watching this video game movie feels like playing a video game.
You know, I guess it registers. I think, honestly, Chris Roberts kind of like overly convoluting the story feels like something that would come from the mind of a video game developer.
Yeah.
Rather than a screenwriter. And, I, you know, by its nature, space dogfighting is like a pretty video gamey thing to shoot.
Uh-huh.
On the other hand, though, like just like the racism and the horniness and the other like human drama elements kind of make this feel more like a movie than a game to me. Although, again, PC games are their own weird subspecies, aren't they?
Uh-huh.
I think I got to stay pretty low, though, because I really kind of forgot that I was watching a video game movie for most of this. I'd go down to probably a 2.0.
Okay, I found myself being a little more generous with this one than I initially expected I was going to be.
Okay.
Because for most of this movie, I felt more like I was like studying for a Naval Academy exam than I was like playing a video game.
Totally.
Things like do admittedly get like a lot gamier in the second half once we actually start getting into the smaller ships. So I'm going to go all the way up to a 3.5 on this one.
All right, a 3.5. I mean, I could see going either way, to be honest. It's just about how it hit you.
That was kind of this movie in a nutshell for me. Let's talk about the fun factor, though, because I felt very strongly about my score on this one.
You know, it's sometimes it's dry. Sometimes
yeah.
It's jargon, and sometimes it's measuring how long it's going to take us to get there versus the enemy. We're going to mention the name of a thing and not really explain what it is, and good luck.
Uh-huh.
But I'm a grown-up. I'm not a child.
Yeah.
And I wasn't shaken too hard by all that stuff. The thing that's not fun about the movie for me is when it becomes Blair's hero story, and
yeah,
it's not about the starfighters and it's not about the tension anymore. It's just about like, can I get MacGuffin to good guy in time? But again, I feel like I'm over the line into having a pretty good time with the movie generally. I'm between a 3 and a 3.5. I'll give it a 3.5. I'll give it a 3.5 for fun factor.
Okay. I think just before I give my rating, I will say that I consider there to be like a distinct difference between like having fun and having a good time.
Yeah, I hear what you mean. Yeah.
I really don't think this movie is going for fun.
No.
So I have to kind of score it appropriately. The only reason I'm not giving this the lowest rating possible is because of Matthew Lillard, who is like, you know, like we've said, the living, breathing comic relief in this movie, and really the only excuse it ever allows itself to try and make you feel like you're having fun. Other than that, though, this is not a very fun movie. I'm going to go down to 1.5 on this one.
I think that's fair, and perhaps will even influence me in the future as I ponder the fun factor of these movies.
Finally, we need to talk about the challenge. We don't go for a number one on this one. We rate it from, what is it, like beginner to expert or something, with a few tiers in between. You know, I think there's plenty of stuff to enjoy about this movie if you're a very specific type of sci-fi nerd.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if you're not into that stuff, this one's probably going to be a struggle for you. And even if you are into, like, the really hard sci-fi stuff, maybe this, you know, 1999 computer game adaptation is not going to quite cut the snuff for you. I'm going to go all the way up to advanced for this one.
I also picked advanced. I'd like to specify that I'm putting it pretty low in the advanced designation. I think if you can sit through an episode of Deep Space Nine, or you can sit through Fargate or whatever, this is not going to challenge you in a way that those shows do. It's a bit medicinal. It goes down a little bit medicinal.
Yeah.
Still, I mean, I feel like I was stimulated in ways I haven't been on this show so far. So
me too. And there were a lot of things I liked about this movie. And if it had been a little differently, I think I would have walked away squarely being a fan of it. So we've just got two more quick segments to do.
That's right.
Before we wrap up. Dylan, we both went into this one with a real lack of experience with Wing Commander. But you, like you do for all the movies we're covering, you went out and played a little bit of the game this thing is based on, right?
I did. First of all, I want to shout out GOG.com, the best digital preservation in the world, because I was able to buy Wing Commander and Wing Commander 2 for $6. They run on my Mac with no fuss, no muss. 1990 PC game, boom, no problem.
Nice.
Here's what it is, Trevor. It's like a narrative-focused, mission-based spaceship flying simulator.
Okay.
You are a rookie pilot. You're on the Tiger Claw, which is like your little hub. That's cool. This is laid out kind of like a point-and-click adventure PC game with like pretty good character facial animation, especially if you think about what's going on the console side in 1990. It's crazy how far ahead PC was at that time. The visuals and the sound are like all very emblematic of my associations with this whole era of like MS-DOS games. It's a nostalgic aesthetic, but it feels like this other branching species of nostalgia that does not belong to me. And I think in a way, the entire Wing Commander franchise is very symbolic of that feeling, you know?
Yep.
Here's a best-selling game series starring Mark Hamill, and there's a dozen novels, and there's a tie-in card game with a competitive scene, and look, a major motion picture adaptation, and you have not heard of any of it. You've never heard of any of this stuff.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, they give you a little AI wingman, and you're given a starfighter, and then you are sent on your merry way into space. You look out of your cockpit into the stars. You fly towards your destination. Your little wingman has like quips. At one time, I accidentally shot her, and she was like, "Respectfully, sir, try firing at the enemy instead," which I thought was cute.
Hey, Star Fox, I'm on your side.
Yeah, exactly. Unfortunately, the dogfighting I found very frustrating and not fun at all. Very disorienting. The mouse moves you around way too quick, and like you can also use the arrow keys, but guess what? They move you around way too slow. So you're just like always getting a glimpse of the enemy ship, and then they duck off screen and you're scrambling to find them again.
Yeah, I feel like dogfighting was a thing that early video games and computer games really wanted to try and get a handle on, but it was just they were too ahead of their time, you know? Like, because I remember some of those early Star Wars cockpit shooters just being a complete nightmare to navigate. At their worst, even like motion sickness inducing.
However, eventually I did die, and I was treated to a very delightful sequence of my character's funeral, where all the Marines are standing like on the ship's deck around my coffin, and then like Admiral Tolwyn is saying all these, he's got great flavor text, he's going like, "It's never easy to lose a pilot, but especially not one as young and promising as Lieutenant Dylan." And then I get to watch my coffin get like launched out into space, and then all the Marines were shooting their blasters up into the stars in my honor. It was very cool.
Wow. You know, I think if I were to have seen something like that at a young video game playing age, it might have like slightly traumatized me.
It was interesting. I felt like my death had real weight.
Maybe this is just a me thing, but I feel like video game deaths are frequently a little too much for me, at least the first time I encounter them. They always feel real, like a little too real to me.
What about game over screens like the one in Donkey Kong Country where they're all fucking beat up and the light's all weird?
Yeah, like I don't want to see that, man.
Diddy, what did they do to you?
Look how they massacred my boy.
My other favorite part of this show, invariably every week, is when I force you to turn on your creative light bulbs, Trevor, and tell me, what would Wing Commander be if it was not, in fact, a video game, but just a movie, and then later it became a video game based on the movie?
Clearly, we're looking at some kind of game about spaceships, right?
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, a flight simulator, that does seem like an obvious route. But like I said, I just don't think we were there yet. And a lot of this movie, to me at least, felt like there was so much more going on to it in addition to just flying the ships, you know? This is a movie about, like, identifying your routes and, like, planning jumps.
Tactics.
Exactly. So this game should be, like, a turn-based kind of tactical strategy game set in space with spaceships, you know, where, like, you've got, like, 10 or so units. You've only got like a set limit where you can move your pieces. They all have different abilities and stuff. Maybe you need to get like all of your little dogfighters to like take down like the enemy's like transport or something like that. It's mothership.
Sure. Or like they give a wall of enemies. You don't got to kill any of them, but you got to get past them to that quasar so you can make the fucking hyper jump.
I mean, these kind of objectives would vary by level, you got to imagine. But I think there's a lot of cool stuff that you could explore in a space like that.
And I assume in between combat, back on the Tiger Claw, you might get to romancing one of your fellow starfighters.
Oh yeah, there'd be all kind of different romance options. There'd be little like in between mission like side quests and stuff you could do. Head over to like the captain's quarters for a little history lesson on the pilgrims and stuff like that.
Wing Commander, download it today for Windows XP.
So what's next? That was Wing Commander. What do we have next coming down the big green pipe?
We are not yet clear of the 1990s, Trevor. We remain trapped next week in the year 1999.
Okay.
I know the cast list of our show has been getting a little bit out of hand. That segment is getting longer and longer. But next week, be sure to clear your schedule, Trevor, because we're going to have 151 different characters to talk about.
Oh, no. It's finally here, huh?
When we watch Pokemon, the first movie, Mewtwo Strikes Back.
Yeah, the first movie.
What a threat.
Yeah, what an ominous series of words.
It should be called Pokemon, the first movie, parentheses, Trevor and Dylan.
Yeah. Well, we'll get through it. We'll do it. You know, I'm excited to see Ash and Pikachu and the gang. You know, I've actually seen this movie before.
I went to see this movie in theater, so we'll definitely have plenty to talk about.
Me too. I'll have to see if I can dig out my Egyptian Mew card.
Oh my God, the one that they would give you at the Cinemark when you got your ticket?
Yeah, of course. We'll talk about all that stuff, though, on the next episode of
this show, which is called Box Office Ba-Bombs. I've been Dylan Flynn.
I've been Trevor Ickrath.
And until next time, so long, Gay Bowser.
This has been a production of
The Lighthouse Keepers Company.
Culture illuminated.